Hi, folks. Steve Urban here, founder and CEO at RiderFlex. We hope you enjoy today's podcast. And as a reminder, please subscribe to the RiderFlex show for updates on new episodes. And by the way, if you haven't already, check out the book we recently launched, The RiderFlex Guide, Inspiring and Hiring, available for purchase on Amazon. And now, a quick word from our sponsor.
Try the number one marketing platform for small business. Everything you need from design to marketing to CRM. Learn more at marketing360.com. Marketing 360. Fuel your brand.
Steve Benson on the RiderFlex podcast here, and I'm telling him about my handyman story. So anyway, Steve, we're walking through this home show, and this kid shakes my hand. He hands me his card. He does his whole thing. He's pitching. And I said, boy, that's a tough business, right? Handyman services, like that's hard. I know a lot of people have tried that. And he goes, well, yeah. He goes, I'm just trying to dominate the Northern Colorado market. And I have some guys that work for me, and we just do miscellaneous stuff. And I said, okay. I said, I'll give you a shot, because I got about 50 little things at the house that I could make a list for. You know, change this doorknob, fix this light switch, paint this door, whatever, right? You know, just stuff I don't want to mess with. Anyway, bottom line is this young kid, he's pitching me. And I said, you own this thing? He goes, yeah, I bought this franchise. I said, really? I said, good for you. I said, how old are you? He said, I'm about 30. I said, all right, man, you're an entrepreneur. I'm an entrepreneur. So I want to give you the business. I want to help you. Anyway, he just came over and he's got one of his guys in here walking around. And I gave him my list of 30 things from my 1953 house, which always has shit wrong with it. Where are you at, Steve? You in Utah?
Yeah, I'm out in Salt Lake, and so I've got my own list of 30 things I'm supposed to be doing, but I try to just chip away at it every weekend, a few more levels.
Right. How old's your house? What year?
It is 1943, I believe.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. You always got stuff.
Luckily, a lot of the stuff's already broken and been replaced, but,
you from Utah originally? Where are you from?
No, I'm actually from Chicago, and, I moved out to California after college, and then, started Badger Maps about 12 years ago. And, this was a California based company. And I opened up offices in Utah and offices in Europe and the Philippines over the years. But then during COVID, almost all the employees that were in the San Francisco office moved to cheaper places. And so I ended up closing that office. And so then I moved to the Salt Lake office.
Interesting. So you grew up in the Chicago area. Is that why you went to college in Wisconsin? Probably, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. It was close enough to drive to.
What'd your folks do?
My mom was an art teacher for grammar school kids, and my dad is a lawyer.
Your dad's a lawyer. Oh, what kind of law?
He used to practice real estate law. Well, I guess he kind of still does. Lawyers never retire. They'll always pick up something here and there, but he's retired. So he was focused on real estate law. But yeah, he had his own. He was an entrepreneur. He just had his own little practice. Hung out a shingle in Chicago.
Is that kind of where you got the original entrepreneurial type bug, you think, from seeing your dad do his thing? Or where do you think that came from?
That's a good question. I didn't start my career to start a business. In business school, I wasn't taking a bunch of entrepreneurial classes or anything. And, I was more, I'd always been on a big company path, right? I worked at IBM and Google, Allstate Insurance. So companies like that, and Google was my last job, and I was working. I'd already my career had been mostly in sales, and my last job at Google, I was the products that I was working with, a lot with like the Google Maps API, and I understood the sales side, so it made sense to make. I saw an opportunity, I guess, and it made a lot of sense that I would do it to make a mapping and routing solution for field salespeople for their mobile devices. And when I started the company, mobile devices were kind of, they weren't a brand new thing, but they you know, we, the first version of Badger Maps, you couldn't run on a phone because the phones weren't powerful enough yet to run the kind of stuff that we're doing. So you needed an iPad to do it on. Mm-hmm. And then, but you know, we were kind of skating to where we saw the puck going as opposed to where the puck had been. And so we knew that, you know, the mobile internet was going to be faster. The phones were going to be faster. The Google Maps API was going to get better. And so all those three things were kind of coming together at the same time. And so this problem that, you know, this set of problems that salespeople had had forever, we were suddenly going to be solvable. As it was becoming possible to solve it, we were building the software to solve it.
But your major when you went to Wisconsin Madison was geography. What the hell were you going to do with that? What was your original plan?
Yeah, I had a major in international relations and geography, and I think I might be the only geography major to ever actually, like, you know, use it and like start a mapping company. But maybe maybe there have been others. But cool. But you know, I kind of ended up with the geography degree. I was working on the international relations degree, and there's actually just a ton of overlap with geography. And so it was a couple extra classes, and I was interested in it. And so I ended up walking away with two majors and a minor, but they were all very related. So it was all kind of one thing, but
yeah,
they're overlapping. The classes counted for, I had classes that counted for the minor, the major, and the other major.
Were you an only child? Or did you have siblings?
No, I have a little sister. She works at the Sierra Club as an attorney.
She followed dad's path as an attorney. Okay. And what kind of kid were you, Steve? Were you a straight A student, library every Friday, or were you partying with the friends? Are you getting called, the sheriff's office calling your dad? Where were you in the mix here?
I was into sports and athletics and I guess I leaned more on the partying side, although, you know, the school stuff always came pretty easily for me. So, okay. You know, I always did fine in school, but it was never a huge focus for me.
Okay. Yeah. So you played sports in high school. Were you like three sport guy, like football, baseball, hockey? What were you?
No, I actually wrestled.
Oh,
so,
all right.
So I was gonna wrestle for the University of Wisconsin, where I ended up going to college. But then they wanted me to weigh like 150 pounds, and I weighed about 200 at the time. And I was like, I'm out. I can't do this for four more years.
Okay, so I know a lot about wrestling because we were a wrestling family, so we got that in common. Both of my sons wrestled and were state placers and all that. So many years in the gym. How'd you do at state when you're in high school?
I got destroyed at the state match in high school by the guy that got fifth. I mean, he was just a monster. his thighs were like the size of my torso, and he was like 8 inches shorter than me. He was like, he had the perfect, like, I'm too tall to be a wrestler, really. Like, I to have excelled at the college level, it was fine. It doesn't matter for high school, but, I'm 6'2" and, I was
that's
wrestling
tall for a wrestler. Yeah. That's tall for a wrestler.
And this guy had just like the perfect wrestler's body, you know, he was like 5'4" and weighed the same as I was wrestling 171 at the time. And he was just, it was like wrestling a tree trunk.
I can relate. My friend, I've seen it all. So, okay. So your mom and dad, they spent many hours in the gym. That's a lot of sacrifice to be a wrestling family. I know, because I did it.
A lot
of sacrifice. Did you do, okay. So you're an athletic guy. So you had fun in school. Nothing crazy though. You didn't go off the deep end. You didn't like, jump on a bus that was painted with flowers on it and travel around the country for 6 months and disappear and drop acid.
No, not really. Wisconsin's a pretty straight and straight place.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. And now, and say, by the way, so is Salt Lake pretty much.
Yeah. Like, well, it's Salt Lake a lot less so. Salt Lake people go one of two ways. They go, you know, it's you're very religious or you're very not. And it's in general. So it's
there's
it's,
nothing in the middle.
Yeah, it when you walk around, it feels like everyone's signaling which side of the team they play for.
That's funny. Are you Mormon?
I am not. No, I started the office here maybe 6-7 years ago because it was close to California. We looked at a bunch of places. The real estate was much cheaper here then, and so you know I wanted a place that employees could put their kids in a good public school and you know own a home. It's kind of crept out of reach now though, and it's Salt Lake has really become a lot more expensive, so you know it makes it a little trickier. But that was my original reasoning for putting it here was the affordability.
And I see.
Well, quality of life and affordability was why I put it here. But the quality of life is still very high here, I think, but the affordability has dropped a lot. It's been one of the parts of the country where the real estate values have really risen quickly.
Mm-hmm. Family, partners, married, what's going on? Kids?
Yeah, I have a wife and I have one child actually. But she's a 9-month-old little girl.
9 months old. How old are you?
I am 44.
Damn, bro. Okay. Woo, man. All right. You're going to be grandpa. You're going to be like 65 by the time she graduates high school. How come you're waiting so long?
I think as many of the entrepreneurs listening to the show probably can relate to, I just, you know, I spent a lot of time in my career the last 20 years, and especially the last, wow. You know, it was my 30s were very hard. I had to do a lot of work in my 30s. And so it just, you know, never really was the right time, I don't think.
Well, how long have you been married?
This woman, I started dating her 2 years ago, 3 years ago, maybe.
Wow. Okay. So, you were single and playing the field for a long time.
Yeah, you know, a few years.
That's a whole nother podcast. That's a whole nother podcast. You got to come back on the show and be like, I want to tell you all my stories from the age 21 through 40, because there's lots of stories in there, Steve. Yeah,
there's a couple decent ones. There's a couple.
How'd you meet your wife?
We met in LA. I moved down there after I closed the office in San Francisco during COVID. I moved to LA. And then I was down there for probably a year and a half, and she's from there. And, so I met her down there.
How the hell did you meet somebody in LA during COVID when the whole damn place was locked down and people are like wearing spacesuits? So how'd that even happen?
You know, LA was not as locked down. So San Francisco was definitely spacesuited up, but LA was, LA, like it was more moderate about things, I think. They didn't pretend there was no COVID, but they also didn't pretend that it was that we had to stay in their bedrooms under a blanket for 2 years.
Okay, well, hey, I appreciate you sharing some of that personal stuff with us. Thank you. You know, it's so many things that happen to you when you grow up, or your family or your folks, or what sports you played or experiences, ties into, you know, who you are, obviously, and kind of shapes your path in so many ways. And so I always like it when people share a little background. So I appreciate you doing that. Thank you. So you worked for several big companies, I guess, when you were at Google, dealing with Google Maps, is that when the seed started for Badger Maps? Kind of walk us through some of that transition there. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, so like I said, I hadn't set out to be an entrepreneur, right? I hadn't set out saying, oh, I, you know, this right. I'm going to run a company and I'm going to start a company. And a lot, you know, a lot of my friends from business school, that was really their goal was to start a business. But then I think when the opportunity presented itself, like basically, you know, I had the idea around it, and I saw a problem that a lot of field and outside salespeople and field service people have with organizing where they're going to be, what their schedule is going to look like, where do I focus on, you know, what's the best route, and really wanting all that on their mobile device, get all the data from their CRM, getting it in, you know, syncing it with a system that they can use on their mobile device. And, you know, that's kind of map focused. I saw all these problems and I was like, there, I could envision the solution to solve those problems. And so that just, that, I guess, seeing the opportunity and seeing that, seeing what was, you know, what it could be, and seeing a real problem that needed to be solved, that is what made me want to be an entrepreneur.
Okay. And did you, what was the last full-time regular W-2 job you had before you quit and went all in on Badger Maps?
That was, so I was in charge of sales of the Google Maps API into the Western US.
Okay. And you started to talk to the listeners. Were you doing this Badger Maps at nights, on the weekends, part-time,
no.
Stealth,
no.
Or did you just, yeah.
I needed to stay at Google because I'd had a really good year there, from a sales perspective. And so I really had to be there till the end of, 2011. So okay. I knew I was planning and plotting, but I don't code software. So I could make plans. I could think about what the product would look like. I could think about who I would need to hire, what kind of team I wanted to build. But I actually didn't start executing until Badger was started January 6th of 2012.
Okay. All right. So you quit. Okay. So you saved up. You had a nest egg saved up. You had some cash saved up, and you just quit and went.
Yeah, I had about $1 million at the time, just under $970 or so.
Sweet.
I was able to spend on starting the business, and it soaked all that up, like between running the company and feeding myself for the first 6 or 7 years. I don't think I was able to pay myself anything.
Okay. Now let me just pause you real quick. First of all, let me go back up. Most people listening to this podcast are not going to be able to bank $1 million before they start their business. What advice would you give, though? Are you telling the listeners, look, do everything you can to save and have a pile of cash of some kind before you start? Because not everybody's going to be able to get to $1 million, right?
Right. And, you know, the reason I had working at in tech at the time was a relatively high paid job, but I mean, it still is. I never had a lot of expenses, right? I didn't spend
you
really
lived.
Any more. Yeah.
You lived below your means. Would you live in a little shack? Would you live in a shack, or what you drove
no.
like a little Hyundai?
Not a Hyundai, but it was a Honda Accord, if I recall it, but it was paid for. I bought it used. So I bought that before business school. And so it was an old Honda Accord, and I didn't live in a shack, but I lived in a, you know, okay neighborhood in San Francisco, like not nice by any means. Like, well, I guess actually it's kind of crappy, but
were you a saver from, were you a saver from the beginning, or you started saving aggressively when you knew you were going to start something, or both?
No, I guess I've always been a saver. I'm not a very good purchaser of things. Like, there's not a lot of things that I want. And so I think when I started making like 600 grand a year, and it's a sales job, right? It was because, you know, I was making that kind of money because, you know, that wasn't my, I was supposed to make like, I think 250 or something, but I was just, you know, I was Google's top salesperson of software. So in the Google Enterprise organization, as we called it then.
How, Steve? Why were you the top salesperson? What? I know that's a whole podcast on sales, but can you give us just a taste? Why were you so good?
I think part of it was right place, right time. I mean, you know, it was great products that I was selling. The year that I was their top salesperson, I was selling Google Apps and Gmail. And it was a great time to be selling that, right?
To who? Who are you selling
to? To businesses and to government organizations. So basically replacing Lotus Notes, replacing GroupWise, and replacing Microsoft Exchange. So kind of corporate and then the collaboration stuff, you know, Google Docs. And it was a great time to be selling that because it was really useful stuff. And so that, you know, but I think having a big pipeline and I was very focused in the top of the funnel. I think, you know, to be great in sales, there's a lot of skill sets that you need, right? You don't have to be like a rock star at any one thing, but you know, you have to be good at all the elements of sales, right? Like if you can't close, you're not going to be good. If you can't qualify, you're not going to be good. If you can't generate leads and build up a pipeline, you're not going to be good. If you're not good at follow-up, you're not going to be good. If you don't, manage up and down and across in the organization and in a company that size, you have to like kind of cordon off resources. And, you know, if you're not good at that type of thing, the politics of it all, you're not going to be good. And so I think, you know, I just wasn't bad at any one part. So nothing really held me back, I think. And I also just got some lucky deals, right? I just got some, you know, I was able to build relationships with certain customers that needed certain things from Google. And I was able to cobble together some pretty interesting stuff for them and some very creative deals.
Congratulations. A major success story for you. Made a lot of money at Google. I'm guessing not being married and not having kids and being able to travel and just get after it helped a little bit.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I was flying to two cities a week usually and moving around a lot and doing things and I didn't have a lot of responsibilities at the time. So, I mean, now I've got a lot of responsibilities. I got a dog to feed, I got a house to take care of, I got a baby.
Okay. So $1 million in the bank, boom, you're off to the races, Badger Maps. Talk to us about those early days. You're not a coder, right? So you didn't write code, but you had the vision. Talk to us about those early days to get it going.
Well, you know, I'm not a coder, but I think it's really valuable to have someone on the founding team who can sell. So one of the founders of a company really needs to be able to really needs to have some sales skills, I think, because especially if you're trying to, it might be different if you're putting together a product that everyone understands. Like if you're opening up gyms or something, that's different. But if you're, did you hear an echo right there? There's a little.
Maybe it's because I took a drink of coffee. I don't know. Go ahead.
Okay.
I'm not getting it on my end. Go ahead.
Okay. Good. Good. It's gone now, but it was coming through pretty strong here. Okay. That's still there. Are you testing, like on a
testing?
Is it playing out loud, like the sound, or is it
testing,
in your ears?
Testing. No, it's out loud, but it's how we've always done it. So it should be.
Okay. It's picking it up. Yeah. It's coming. It's circling back. Your mic is picking up my voice on the way on the.
Test.
If you pulled the speaker further away from the mic, it might help.
Let me try something here. Testing, listeners, podcast troubles.
Well, I think it's my voice coming out of the speakers on your side and then getting
How are you doing now? Is it better?
Yeah.
Is it better?
Yeah, that's better. I can't hear it anymore.
$1 million in the bank. Go ahead. Founder. One of the founders has got to be a seller. And you were that person, right?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, and it's really important that a founder can sell, I think. Someone on the founding team, because it needs to be someone that has a seat at the table on the decisions of the company, right? So if no one with power in the company is really getting in front of customers and really interacting with them, it's very easy to create a product that isn't exactly what customers needed. And you can sail your ship at, you know, 5 degrees off for 100 miles and end up pretty far off the mark that you would have needed to be at. Mm-hmm. And you see that a lot in technology. If no one with power in a startup has kind of that customer orientation. So I couldn't code the stuff, but I could help us figure out what we needed to do to what we needed to build. Right. So I was talking with hundreds of people that I thought were the early customers of our product. And our product's tricky, right? Because there's not just one purchaser of it. It's not, there's several, it's an enterprise software product. So there's several people with their fingers in the bowl, right? There's, there's sales leadership and sales operations, sales enablement, sales trainers, and then the actual salesperson who, or service person, if it's a service organization, who uses the product out in the field, right? And so I needed to have a lot of interaction with all those different types of people to understand what each one needed and what was important to each one, and to be the early leads, right? You know, those people that I was talking to saying, hey, you know, this is what we're building. I think this is useful. Is this useful to you? And this part's important. And would you buy it like for this much money if I built it? And if a lot of people are like, oh yeah, if you could solve that problem for us, we would definitely buy that for that much money. That'd be a slam dunk.
Using your list, your network list from all the customers that you had dealt with at Google, a lot of friends and connections and network that you had made up or had conquered during that time?
Not really. No, it was reaching out to a new, it was because the buyer of the products I was selling at Google was a different person than the buyer of this product. I didn't know a bunch of, you know, sales operations people at medical device companies and, you know, things like that. VPs of sales at construction firms, like, or, you know, companies that make products like that. That's who has field sales teams, you know, it's pharmaceutical, med device, stuff like that. So I didn't have contacts in those things, but I would reach out to them and I would say, hey, we're doing this. I think it'd be useful to you. I'd love to pick your brain and get to know if we're actually making something that would be useful for you. And a lot of people will get on the phone and then you can ask them, you know, walk them through what you're doing and ask them if they'd buy it for this price. And if the answer is yes, you put them on a list saying, okay, well, we're building this and I'll reach back out to you once it's built in about 6 months to a year. Once we have something that's really valuable to people.
How long did it take you to get the first prototype out there? How long for the first version?
It was about a year. A prototype came out pretty fast, but something that was actually going to be valuable and usable by people in the field. You know, the original version was just taking all their customer data from their CRM or wherever their data lived and putting it on a map. And then the second version, which came out, is just so they could see where is everything in relation to one another. And, you know, literally the low tech version of it would be to put a paper map on the wall and stick colored pins where all your customers are. Then the next version, next versions that came out were like, well, okay, now we can change all the colors of the pins based on, you know, the different information you have about your customers. Like, oh, this is this type of customer, this is that type of customer, or customers by size, colorizing them. And then building routes came, and then putting it on the different platforms like the, you know, Android and the iPhone, because the first version only worked on the computer.
How long was it before you could actually charge people for the software? When did you actually start getting paid by clients? Was that a year, 2 years? How far in were you?
Just under a year. I think about nine months.
Okay. All right. Very good. That's good. All right. But you didn't start paying yourself, you said, for the first 5 years you didn't pay yourself?
I think it was six or seven. It was a long time. I think it was about six.
Wow. So it
helped that my burn rate was low. You know, I wasn't spending a lot of money, and it helped that I threw $100,000 into Amazon in 2012. So that stock did really
good
well
for you.
Over that was kind of just my piggy bank. I kept taking $20,000 out at a time, and that helped a lot, I think. You know, it was a good gamble. And
so is Bootstrap. You bootstrapped the whole thing yourself. No outside cash, no other partners, no other co-founders to put in money.
No, there was another co-founder and he brought along some cash too, buddy from business school. And then we brought in about $400,000 of outside money, friends and family early on.
Ah, Oh, really? Oh, okay. Is that co-founder still involved in the business?
No, no. He left after about 2 years.
Oh, he didn't make it very long.
he was there for some of the hard parts, but wasn't. He didn't love being an entrepreneur. He wanted to go back to, he's a high finance guy and, you know, private equity. And that was a cleaner career path. This one,
did you buy his units back, or are you cutting him distribution checks every year?
No distribution checks yet. We're not profitable yet. We invest all the money back into the business. He kept some of his stock.
All right.
So, software companies, you tend not to cash flow, and you want to cash flow as quick as you can. But we're at $5.5 million in revenue now. So,
or still burning cash?
Yeah, we're more or less broken even. We've taken about $2.5 million in debt over the years. Couple sources. We've refinanced our debt a couple times. So I guess I've used three debt providers over the years. And then a few, you know, friends and family here and there. But yeah, there's a bunch of, and that's a whole other conversation. There's a whole what to watch out for with debt, you know, how to find good lenders. But banks don't make loans in this space. Like if I were a restaurant making $5.5 million, you know, they would make you a loan with your oven and stuff as collateral. But we, as a software company, we don't really have collateral, right? I have we have chairs and desks, but nothing's really worth anything. So banks really aren't in until you're a bit bigger and probably a little profitable. But there are especially debt providers that make loans into the software space because they like the recurring revenue model, and they can see, well, if you've got 5.5 million come in, and we can see the rate at which it's churning, we can see the rate at which it's growing, we can get comfortable around your ability to pay us back.
And can you teach the listeners collateral wise, what are you having to put up for that? Do they score on equity if you can't pay it back? Did you have to put up a personal guarantee? Can you teach the listeners a little bit about that?
There's no personal guarantee on this type of debt, but I mean, the company is the backing. So the ownership, the stock of the company is the backing. So you have to pay it. You have to pay your debt or you lose your company, right? And the sad thing about not doing business with banks is that debt providers of this nature are much more expensive, right? So
yes,
the crappy ones are 30%. The good ones are around 16% or so, 16 to 18%. So our original debt was about 18%. And then our current provider, it's about 16%.
Gotcha. Okay. Total cash all in. Do you mind sharing? You took what, $2.5 million in debt, but if you counted, have you ever added up? You probably don't want to. Have you ever added up all the cash you've put in and included the 6 years you spent not paying yourself and sweat equity, and kind of looked at all that and said, damn, here's how much I've put in. You ever done that math?
Yeah. I mean, I could back of the envelope that, you know, pretty easily. So there's the 2.5 that we have in debt. There's the probably about the $400K that we raised from friends and family.
Okay. Now you're at 3 million.
Yeah. The co-founder and I probably put in about 400, 500 a week. It's about five. So that's another million. So now we're at $4 million. Depending on what we want to say the market value of my time's worth, like
another million.
Yeah, for 5 years, yeah, that's probably fair. So you know, we're up to
five million, and now the company's doing, what'd you say, 5 million in revenue, roughly
5.5.
Okay, breaking even, but that's because you're kind of forcing it to do that. You could, if you normalized EBITDA and wanted it to show a profit, you could if you wanted to, but you're investing back into the business for scaling up, marketing, whatever.
Right, yeah. I mean, if we wanted the business to be profitable, we would just have fewer people helping our customers, fewer engineers making the product. I mean, it's a big engineering team, you know, 25, 30 people. And that's expensive.
Yeah. What's your total employee count right now?
About 70.
70 employees. Okay. And your wife, did you tell me already? And I forgot, what does she do?
She used to run a small business and now she's just dealing with the baby right now.
Which is great. But the reason I asked what she did for a living is because I'm sure she's glad you're finally paying yourself something. At least you're taking a salary.
That's right. Yeah. She appreciates that. and I have been taking a salary for years, but it's not a big one or anything. I pay myself like 87K a year.
Wow. So, wow.
Pretty, you know, it's not a great salary, but it pays the bills, buys the baby toys.
You know, it's interesting. Let's take a pause right there for the listeners. So you openly share that, which I think is great. And I'm sure your employees probably know, or at least your leadership team or your executives probably know what you're paying yourself. Mm-hmm. I do the exact same thing at Riderflex. My co-founder and I, Scott, we openly share a lot of our financials with the leadership team. They see exactly what we're paying ourselves. I want them to see it because we're paying ourselves less than most of the recruiters that work on the team. And I want them to see that, right? I want them to see like, hey, I am willing to do what it takes as a founder to push cash towards people and software or marketing or whatever we need. Like I want to grow the business and I'm not here as an owner to just grab a big fat salary. And so I share it with them. I encourage anybody listening to this episode, share as much as you can with your team to show them where the cash is going. I think the more the leadership team knows, the better personally.
Yeah. And I, you know, anyone at the company that works here, I guess, could figure, you know, they can know what I make. I mean, they could listen to this podcast, I don't keep it a secret. Right. It was like 50, I think it was 52,000 for several years. And then I've kind of given myself bumps over the last maybe 3 years.
That's nice. Yeah, that's good. But, it's good. You're paying your engineers a lot more than that, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so that's, I think that's motivating for people. I think it's important and, you know, it's on you to sacrifice if it's your baby, you've got to be the one sacrificing, right? Cause you can't,
no doubt about it.
You can't
no doubt
expect. About
it. Are you in a cash raise situation now? Are you got anything you're pitching? You got a round you're raising or anything or no?
No, we've never raised outside capital of that, you know, professional money. At some point we may, there's a few market conditions under which it would be the right thing to do. Okay. Like if I had a meaningful competitor that I was concerned they were catching up to us, or if there was a company that I wanted to buy, I mean, you gotta buy companies with money. So I'd need to borrow some from somewhere or raise equity from somewhere.
Okay.
And the third, it would be if I wanted to sell a chunk of the company, and kind of, you know, cash out and sell 20% of the business, that would be a good, you know, there's private equity firms that like to do that sort of thing. Once it's a certain
what is
size.
The plan? What is the plan, Steve? Do you want Google to buy you at some point? What's the plan?
Well, it wouldn't make a ton of sense for Google to buy this. My biggest competitor was bought by Salesforce, and it's called Salesforce Maps now. And we compete well against them, even on the Salesforce platform, because they've kind of gone in a slightly different direction than kind of our area of focus, which is the people and the folks in the field. Okay. But we compete well against them, I think, in that environment. But all the CRMs that we bring mapping and routing and these type in this, you know, mobility to, any of them would make sense as a acquirer. CRM systems aren't terribly acquisitive in general, other than Salesforce. Salesforce buys a lot of stuff.
Did they approach you before they approached your competitor?
No, their competitor was always very focused on just that ecosystem. So we had two slightly different strategies. So they did this stuff just for Salesforce. Our strategy is to do it for all CRMs.
I see.
But you know, they've always been closer with Salesforce and they used to have a better integration to Salesforce. You know, they don't anymore, but they used to. And so that was a much more logical play for Salesforce.
Okay. Badgermapping.com. Just so everybody knows the URL. Steve Benson also, of course, on LinkedIn, where he's got like, I don't know, 20,000 followers or more. Can you give a quick 2-3 minute elevator pitch on Badger Mapping? I know we've talked a lot about the back end story of the company, but for anybody that may need the tool, and hasn't heard of Badger Mapping, give us the pitch real quick. Go for it.
Sure. So what we do at Badger is we bring mapping and routing to your data on your mobile device. So whether your data is in your CRM, and generally it's for salespeople on their customer data, but sometimes it's also a variety of service type and interactions that are out in the field that aren't with customers necessarily, but it could be managing machines or other things that are out in the world. But the point is they have data, usually it's customers, and then we put it on a map for them, help them figure out which ones to focus on or prioritize, especially if it's a salesperson. We have a lot of capabilities around that to help them manage their time and figure out who should I really be focused on. And we do all this on their mobile device, right? So we've built all these tools around a map on their mobile device, which is really useful for people that are out in the field to kind of have a geographic window to look at all their data in. And so it's things like routing and mapping and data analytics tools that allow them to kind of slice and dice their information and figure out what's important.
And how do you, what's the business model? Are you charging by user?
Kind of standard software. It's $59 a month if they're buying it monthly, per person using it. Yeah. So if you have a sales team with 100 people on it, it's 59 times 100 a month. Or if they buy it annually, it goes down to $49.
So if they pay the whole year up front, you give them a little bit of a discount.
Yeah, which is pretty standard in software.
But you can go month to month if you want to. You don't have to sign a long-term contract.
Exactly. Yeah. Which some people like, you know, because that especially that in the beginning, it lets them try it out in a risk-free way, which is what I like about it. It's like, well, and we have trials for teams too. And individuals too. And individual using it, they have a 3-week free trial, but they can kick the tires on it, make sure it works for them. And if they want a longer, I mean, you can do a 6-month trial 1 month at a time, right? So, once you know, our team's going to keep using this. This is working well for us. It you do save some money paying annually, and this is all pretty common in software to do it this way.
Okay. And if certain industries, certain size companies, any particular target market for you?
I mean, we've got customers with 1,000 people in the field. We've got customers with that are just single users that are the only salesperson or service outfield worker in at their company. And we've got some that, you know, are one salesperson out of 1,000, but only one uses it. So it can be a small company or a big company. The important thing is that there's folks going out in the field that want to be better organized, have a map of what they're doing out there, have route building and schedule building capabilities. There are certain industries where you see a lot of this. I mean, like medical device, for example. If you're selling, you know, a tool to dentists, you do that not by setting up a website for it. I mean, they have a website too, but you go out and you know, show it to the dentist, talk to the dentist about why it would help them do their job better. You get in front of them. And so you see that in certain industries more than others. So medical device, pharmaceutical, a lot of stuff like construction equipment, anything that you use to build stuff with. But it's a whole, you know, outside sales or field sales and field services. There's a lot of that you see that in certain industries.
Okay. And now that you're 11, 12 years in here and you're at 5 million, what is Steve Benson's daily role now? I mean, I know you still got, you still carry the CEO title, but are you just at 30,000 feet with strategy? Are you down in the weeds? What are you participating in tactically kind of day to day now? I'm just curious.
You know, there's a lot of zooming in and out of the weeds to 30,000 feet. I think, you know, there are certain areas of the company where I still run everything. And there's areas of the company that I've been able to completely take the hat off and I just get the reports and, you know, meet with the management teams of those areas and hear about what they're doing and help shape the strategy of, for that part of the team. But I don't get into the tactics of it at all. So, and there are certain things that as a founder, I think everyone you're good at and you can keep leveraging those strengths. But in general, I think, you know, I try to spend my time on things that on enabling people and building the team to be great, as opposed to me actually getting in the weeds. But I do find myself in the weeds in certain areas. I mean, and I still talk to customers. I mean, I don't do it a ton, but for strategic customers or important customers, I'll show up and, you know, I'll jump on a plane to meet a current customer who is would want to meet or a prospective customer. You know, I do still do some of that. And there are certain things in like marketing that, you know, I'm kind of uniquely positioned to do because I'm the voice of the company and the
like
face
the podcast,
of things.
For example, like that. Are you doing the Outside Sales Talk podcast still or no?
Yeah, absolutely. That's gone really well. I mean, we get a lot of listeners to that. It's a unique podcast because it's specifically for outside salespeople, and I bring on sales thought leaders and have them
give their
spiel that people pay a lot of money for to have them come. You know, you got to pay these guys 10 grand to come in and talk to your company. They'll kind of do that spiel on the podcast, more or less a similar spiel, but they'll do it through the lens of knowing that it's outside sales people listening to the podcast primarily. Yes. And so it's a pretty useful podcast because we get some impressive people on there. So it's not that I'm saying anything clever. It's the folks that we have on there and that's been popular. That's something I do. I have, I just did an episode yesterday actually.
Well, I just clicked on your YouTube of it. So it's on YouTube, Spotify, and basically everywhere a podcast can be heard, right? Pretty much.
Yeah. It's all over the place. And it's funny, like YouTube, sometimes you get, you know, 30,000 views, sometimes you get very few, but the podcast platforms are very stable, you know?
Yeah. Very good. Well, congratulations, my friend, on everything that you have built so far. And, you know, kudos to basically bootstrapping the whole thing. I mean, you have invested a lot of personal money and personal time. I mean, and a lot of sweat equity to get this thing up and running. And now here you are 11, 12 years later, it's moving along. It's at 5 million, roughly 70 employees. You haven't had to take on a PE or VC partner that took 51% and pushed you aside. Thank goodness.
that's the goal, to avoid that.
Yeah, right. Like you're still in charge of everything. So and it's a very useful tool. I mean, you know, it's like you said, you worked hard to solve a problem that you saw, and you went all in and invested a lot of money to do it. I mean, congratulations on everything you've built so far, my friend. Check out Steve's podcast, as I mentioned, and badgermapping.com as well if you want to sign up, and you can get your free trial, which is cool. I like that. I always like free trials.
Yeah, and you know, mention to the salespeople that you heard me on this podcast, and they'll do 2 months free for you just so you can really kick the tires and
awesome.
Make sure that just mention Steve Urban.
Yeah, mention Steve Urban, the Rider Flex podcast. Steve Benson, thank you, sir. Appreciate you sharing your story.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.